Welcome to Pleb Chain Radio, a live show brought to you by Plebs for Plebs, which focuses on the intersection of Nostr and Bitcoin protocols. Join QW and Avi as they run down the weekly news and developments, breaking down the current thing and the future frontier with the foundation of decentralization, the builders, thinkers, doers, and plebs. All right, we are live.
Welcome, gentle plebs, to episode number 68 of Plebchain Radio. Today is Friday, July 5th, and it is 2:14 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States at the time of recording. We have a fun show ahead of you today. Max Hillebrand, cypherpunk, philosopher, and most importantly, gentle pleb, is joining us today to talk about all of those things and more. Just a reminder that if you are listening to the show on Spotify or Apple, first of all, thank you for listening. But I would suggest, I would urge you to hit pause and switch to Fountain, where you can earn some sats while listening and support the value for value movement. We're also available on Fanfares, a new Nostr client where you can pay sats. And in our case, QW is just 100 sats, but you can pay sats and listen to the show ad-free. Of course, the twist here is there are no ads on Fountain either. You can, of course, if you're listening live, you can listen on NostrNess or on Zap.stream. So thank you all for joining and listening. QW, before we jump into our sermon, there is some exciting news for us to share. We are announcing a partnership with the Bitcoin Bugle. And for that, this is more for the listeners of the podcast. There is a little clip that's going to play right after this.
In a world dominated by the podcast and conference industrial complex,
who is Richard Griesser?
Where the public square has been astroturfed by Tether, bold voices have started speaking up and taking a stand.
Where did the McDonald's dollar menu go?
A grassroots resistance is emerging from the shadows, fueled by defiance.
Only fools follow the rules.
They say that no force on earth can stop an idea whose time has come.
The intellectual Silk Road is inevitable.
And now that force is getting stronger. This summer, the Bugle and Pleb Chain Radio will unite their value for value communities to form an alliance of decentralized non-compliance. Tune in each week as Richard Griesser, Rod Palmer, Avi Burra, and Quiet Warrior battle the CIA to save Bitcoin's soul. The most thermodynamically sound Sybil defense in history is coming to Nostr clients and Fountain apps around the world. Bitcoin has already won. Time to act like it.
And as regards what that partnership actually entails, stay tuned to find out more over the course of the summer.
You never know.
Before the sermon,
happy anniversary to you and your lovely better half. I believe you were in the last week too, right?
It certainly was, QW. thank you. Thank you for doxing that. But
Well, you know, I'm sitting here in the cabin, staring out at the pine trees. Once again, something about the pine trees just makes me fall in love with the earth, I suppose. But yeah, I'm celebrating my 15th anniversary. So I just it's kind of funny how we end up in the same realm, being so far apart as different people, but end up in the same, little basket at the bottom of life's Plinko, I would say.
Yeah. You could almost say Nostr fixes this.
It does.
but thank you. I appreciate you saying that, QW, and the very same to you. I think it's the same number as well. So that is, ain't that something?
We'll have to do 21 together.
But that's true. Yeah, we'll leave our wives behind and we'll hang out. for our sermon today, a decentralized resistance. And we talked about the Bugle just a second ago, right? For those who might be unaware, the Bitcoin Bugle is a satirical website, X and Noster account run by two folks, Rod Palmer and Dick Griezer, very real names, as you would imagine. And sort of modeled on the Babylon Bee or the Onion, or what the Onion used to be once upon a time.
A very credentialed set of journalists, I must say.
A highly credentialed set of journalists, indeed. And they introduced us recently to the term PodConf. So what is PodConf, right? It's short for the Podcasting and Conference Industrial Complex. And what they mean by this is it's this amalgam, this amorphous entity that now exists in the Bitcoin world of these large Bitcoin conferences, except for BTC Prague. No, nothing bad to say about them. So they are exempted, QW. By the way, use discount code Noster for 10% off tickets next year for BTC Prague.
We're already pumping next year.
Pumping next year. With the exception of BTC Prague, there are several large Bitcoin conferences that have popped up all over the world, and there's several podcasts and run by influencers, and a lot of them are pushing or heavily focused on NGU culture, right? Number go up at all costs. And what the worrying thing, and the Bugle have caught on to this trend, others have as well, you and I certainly, KW, but the Bugle is really shining a light on it through satire, which is that this NGU at all costs culture is the most generous thing I could say is it is inadvertently pushing compliance, right? KYC, non-custodial wallets, no privacy, because if the focus is number go up, irrespective of what, I mean, they're trying to convince people to do anything to drive adoption. But QW, here's a question for you. Does number go up even matter if we've given up all of our basic freedoms?
No, not at all. I mean, it's why did Bitcoin become, what was the origin of it? Why was it created? It wasn't for number go up. It was really more the sly roundabout way. So it's not only that too. When you have these talking heads that constantly focus on the short term, Bitcoin 100K by December, Bitcoin 1 million, 8 million. It just burns me out. It's just like, I don't want to, it's annoying in all honesty. And the more you understand Bitcoin, the more you understand the ethos and the privacy aspect of just a cypherpunk movement, all the way into Noster and the decentralized freedom. It's something that it just burns you out. You're not really interested in that. It's kind of, I don't know if it's just a low time. It's a very high time preference way of looking at Bitcoin. And it's not cultural fertilizer, I would say. It's a degenerate carrot to chase when you just talk about price all the time. To me, I've told you guys this. I completely turned off the prices, any of the signal on my phone. I just can't even. I just don't care. That's not where my heart is right now. I'm focused on the change that I can actually touch. But we see the ethos kind of being stripped away in the game of whack-a-mole right now. In the regulatory side of things right now. So it's something where when we talk about a decentralized resistance, just like we're doing with the Bugle, you got to unite the clan sometimes, come together, fight for what actually matters in this cultural movement. And number go up, I think, is a distraction from it in the long game.
It's certainly time to push back against these forces of centralization. And again, charitably, I'm willing to say this is happening inadvertently, right? It is people's high time preference clouding their views and leading them down this path. But if the core reason why we're part of this peaceful revolution, KW, and I'm using the term we because I'd like to believe that this is what this peaceful revolution is about. It's about freedom and sovereignty, about creating a more peaceful and more abundant world, not just for ourselves, but certainly for our children. If those are addressed, right, sovereignty and freedom, then how does it matter? We're all going to be happy, right? And then number go up is going to be either inevitable, but I think even better, it's going to be irrelevant, because how does it matter? We're happy. We've gotten to the promised land. And, you know, tying this into the guest segment, KW, one of the casualties, I mean, obviously KYC is one, custody is another one, but privacy in my mind is one of the biggest ones. How have we, as a distributed community across the world, convinced ourselves that it's okay to give up privacy as long as number go up happens?
We have to keep talking about it. We just have to. I don't even know if some people realize it. You know what I mean? It's that whole Overton window. We've had these talks before where it's like, you know, if you got nothing to hide, it's just so silly. And I think we just got to keep talking about it. That's what we're doing as a team here. So, and also when you talk about the decentralized resistance in the pod comp, I love the fact that Noster's kind of spreading to all these conferences. It creates a very vigorous force, I would say, at each one of these conferences. And if we can keep the culture of Noster very, very cypherpunk ethos, I think we're on the right track with having a lot of influence to counter this, right?
You know, you just reminded me of, I'm going to do that thing I occasionally do, KW, and narrate a meme. So it's the Gates of Troy are opening up. It's BotConf on one side. The Trojan horse is Noster. And what we're pushing is cypherpunk, right? That's what it
That's
is.
That's it. And everything is sly roundabout way, right? We always have to do this. And number go up is not the way.
It certainly isn't. And speaking about talking about this some more, it's my pleasure to introduce our guest, Max Hillebrand. Welcome to PlebChain Radio.
Yeah, hello and welcome, gentle plebs. Looking forward to the conversation. Long time listener, first time speaker.
Really Love happy it. To have you. My first time actually ever talking to you, ever really getting to know who you are. So you know, I love being in these kind of shows where, you know, you might have known Avi for a couple of years, and I kind of do the sideline, you know, side saddle. I'm you know, me and the Avi's in the motorcycle, and I'm in the little side cab. That's this show right now. So I'm looking to learn and really enjoy, looking forward to this show.
Quiet but diligent, right?
Max and I have broken steak together many times.
It's a proper bondage, right? It's a we're brothers, basically.
It's like a meat sweat ceremony.
There you go.
We haven't been in the sauna yet, so that's definitely missing, though.
Yes, maybe one of these, maybe next year, Oslo. We'll see if we can make that work. So, Max, here's a burning question for you. There's actually, we usually do a silly burning question, but I've decided to ask a serious one this time, which is, you know, based on what we were talking about in the sermon, is it possible to have an app that where a user has self-custody, privacy, and good UX at the same time? Or is this another one of those trilemmas that we have to work around?
No, I think it's possible. It's just fucking a lot of work. You know, that's the main issue. But there's a great research paper for anyone interested in a bit more theoretical part of this called Anonymity Loves Company. I forgot the subtitle of it, but it was related to the Tor project. And here, basically, the thing is that if we want to have privacy preserving technologies, then in many cases we need a crowd to hide in, and we're only gonna, and the larger the crowd the better, right? That's the anonymity set, larger is better. But how are we going to get a large number of people involved in this project? And if it's technically difficult, if it's expensive in terms of time, talent, and such, that in order to use a tech, then fewer people are going to use it. And even more so, if there is a lot of configuration that has to be done in order to be part of the actually privacy-preserving crowd, then the crowd will inherently be small, because only defaults matter in the grand scheme of things. And we basically need to build tech where the default use case is one of security and privacy. If that is the case, then using the private tech isn't difficult, because all of the magic just happens by default in the background. And I guess Wasabi Wallet was since the beginning a great example for this. Because like all the way in 2018, it came with numerous privacy by default features like Tor, right? The Tor daemon was bundled inside the Wasabi package. And as soon as you start Wasabi, you start Tor, right? There doesn't matter if you have Tor pre-installed, you don't need to configure it and open ports or other nonsense. You just run Wasabi and it runs Tor and all the traffic goes through Tor. Or same with block filters, for example, right? You run Wasabi and it synchronizes the wallet, and by default, your private or your public keys, your addresses never get leaked to a third-party server. And these types of things are we already achieved to make default in Wasabi 1.0, right? And you didn't need like rocket science in order to use these two aspects of the wallet correctly. You just run the software and 100% of the users did it correctly, just by the fact of running the software. Where however, it was a lot more difficult to do this was with coin joins specifically, right? Where in Wasabi 1.0, you know, we showed a list of UTXOs, you had to manually select them and say, yes, now start the coin join process, and then crazy timer appears and it fails and goes back, you know, and lots of complexities exposed to the end user, where for one, it's quite overwhelming just to see this information, even more difficult to understand it, and then to use the software in a correct way based on the info that it gives you. And so all of these was extremely difficult with Wasabi 1.0, and it led to a lot of user confusion, user uncertainty, and user mistakes. Right? People fucked up their privacy a lot because it was possible for them to do these steps in the user interface. And I guess the largest learning we had with Wasabi 2.0 was that even more has to be done by default. It's not enough if just Tor and wallet sync is private by default. Blockchain level privacy must be protected by default as well. And that's why, for example, in Wasabi, you download a wallet, the software, you create a new set of keys, you send your first Bitcoin to the wallet. If the wallet stays open, in fact, even if you click like the red cross on the top right to close the user interface, the wallet will still remain open. And as soon as your payments get confirmed, it will start coin joining and making your money private, so that you don't have to change any of the settings in order to actually be private. So I think it is possible. It's in fact necessary that these techs are easy to use.
You know, Max, just a quick sidebar on that default coin join. Back when I was able to use, it's not available anymore, obviously, I'm in the US, but a funny story there. So you remember the bounty I had in my book 24, right? For 70 million sats or so.
Yep.
When I moved the first 10 million sats in there, I was using Wasabi to manage it. And then I took the address and I put it up on X and on Nosa saying, hey, check out this address. And then I got pinged by people saying, what are you talking about? It's empty. There's nothing in there. And I realized it had default coin joined and moved to a different address. So I had to turn off the coin. I think I pinged you around that. I said, hey, Max, what's happening? And he said, you got to turn the default off.
You see, Wasabi is so safe that even when you want to brag publicly about, look at my address and how full it is, right? Wasabi protects you from even such a bragging case.
So we'll talk a little more about Wasabi in a second, Max. But what is... I'm curious to know, what who was Max Hillebrand before Wasabi happened? What were you up to?
Well, basically studying economics. That was my main hobby before. And entrepreneurship, you know, seeing why are humans productive and how can we be more productive? That was a really fascinating question for me. And after some stumbling around with mainstream economics, I eventually found the Austrian school. And that's so obviously correct that, well, you just continue enjoying it. That was my main rabbit hole. So I was deep into monetary economics long before discovering Bitcoin. And that gave me a cool head start to some extent in the economic side. And that allowed me to focus on some other areas of Bitcoin where I could learn even more. So that's when I dove deep into the technology, the cypherpunk philosophy, and the architecture of these cryptographic systems that we can use for your human liberation.
And was that the inspiration for Wasabi how did that happen as you got more and more into the Austrian School of Economics and Liberty and all of these ideas?
Yeah, I thought I knew a bit about economics before Bitcoin, but then Bitcoin really teaches you that you know very little. And then it also helps you to refine a lot of these concepts, right? So a lot of the things that I previously just thought that I understood because I've read it somewhere, with Bitcoin, it really forces you to reconceptualize this, right? Because you need to adapt an existing set of truths to a very new set of parameters. It's not just a copy and paste job, right? You need to think things through on how it actually adapts in such a radically new environment like Bitcoin. But the cool thing is that Austrian economics is extremely helpful with this, right? Because you think Ludwig von Mises, he wrote 100 years ago, right? All of the great Rothbard books are 50 years plus before the internet, right? Before computers, basically. How come that these people had such a incredibly eloquent way of explaining why Bitcoin is important and why it actually works and why people like it? That is just fascinating on how rather old ideas stand up the test of time, even though the environment so radically shifts.
And were you a developer, Max, or were you an EA student of economics?
No, I'm still not a developer to this day. I write some Bash, if that counts, so I can use the Linux terminal. I thought for a long time of should I actually get into coding and development. And maybe if I would have done it a couple of years ago, by now I would have been quite happy. But what I also did realize is that there's a lot of other tasks that need to be done in free software projects that do not require coding. So I'm an other stuff maximalist that I basically do everything but code. And it seems to me that developers value these types of contributions sometimes even more than if another developer tries to push with their code. Division of labor is a beautiful thing, and devs should focus on coding, and I guess thinkers should be focusing on thinking. And that's why I really enjoyed a lot to delve deep into the aspects of the technology, of the software technology that I do understand, right? So I couldn't explain the nuances of computer science and stuff or exactly analyze how lines of code behave. But on the other hand, I kind of see the large picture, right? And I understand the gist of the basic blocks, right? I understand roughly the core principles of a hash function, and private public keys or different key handshake mechanisms. I can kind of reason through these on a higher level and then maybe find out which type of cool things we can build with such building blocks. That's more of my area of expertise.
So you founded Wasabi though, didn't you?
No, not really. I was one of the early fans and users, but originally the project was founded as Hidden Wallet by Nopara 73. He's been studying and researching Bitcoin privacy tech for since around 2015. And looked into different protocols to improve Bitcoin's privacy, and until eventually settling in with CoinJoins as a practical and implementable and reasonably simple solution. And that was then first done in the research project called Hidden Wallet. It was more of a proof of concept. It never really worked properly, right? But and then Wasabi Wallet 1.0 was launched in 2018, at the 1 year anniversary of the SegWit activation, actually, I think August 1st. And then, yeah, that was the start of Wasabi Wallet proper. And yeah, I stumbled upon Hidden Wallet, actually, you know, from the, what do you call it? The podcast and conference cult or secret society.
Industrial complex.
Yeah. Industrial complex, yes. So there's the OG amazing podcast Block Digest. Funnily, quite similar to PlebChain Radio, actually. Similar vibes, you know. Just
we copied them. We copied them.
Exactly.
Just kidding. I'm actually never heard of that, but interesting.
It's like from Shinobi and Janine Rimmer, Andrik, like really, really excellent stuff. Especially, oh man, during UASF and the whole block size wars, that was such a sanctuary of reason and honest, good debate. These guys definitely like saved me during this time in terms of sanity and understanding. And yeah, they were just talking about all types of cutting edge, amazing technology that was happening. And Nopara, the developer of Wasabi, was also a co-host there. And then he just shared some work in progress. And I found that very interesting and tried it out on testnet. And yeah, found a bunch of bugs and things that how it could be made better. And I just didn't shut up with feature requests and bug reports. And so I guess they had to endure me for a couple of years now.
So what is or was your role at Wasabi when you got involved properly?
Yeah, everything but code. So it started out with videos, you know, lots of tutorial, educational videos, how to use the wallet step by step, you know, PTC session style. Interviews with the people working on it, you know, like summarizing the latest progresses, making an update on like video about the releases, you know, what's new. Then I joined more and more of the dev calls. You know, they're just most open source projects. You can just join the call and have conversations with like most rock star developers about technical nuances. So at first you're just quiet and listen and try to accumulate as much knowledge as possible. But then sooner or later, you actually realize that you've learned quite a lot just by lurking. And then maybe your comments start to be useful as well. So yeah, I was there for, you know, researching stuff and coordinating people, and you know, one dev built something awesome and I get excited about it and start talking to him about it, and then another dev sees the same thing and doesn't know much about it. So now I can tell the second developer about what the first developer told me, and I can help one dev understand something, so and the other devs don't have to do it, right? Again, division of labor. Like, these guys are rockstar level coders. They could earn like, I don't know, $800,000 a year at Google, and they're just here doing like awesome freedom tech. So the last thing we should be doing is slowing them down with meaningless tasks that are repetitive and where something where they're not the best at, right? They're like the best coders on the planet. They should be doing nothing else but coding and not doing things like customer support and answering the same question like 50 times. So that's the type of work that I provided, you know, basically just covering the devs and giving them the free space to get shit done.
I see that a lot where we have these open source projects and they're very small. You know, maybe the funding isn't there, or maybe they have none at all. And they end up being the tech support guy or girl too, you know, and it's like, I don't know how that's got to just burn a brain when you're trying to develop something, trying to get beta, alpha, beta, you know, get testers out there. But then you're also the one that's always answering all the questions. I think that's that was a tremendous point you made. I also like the fact that you're not a developer, but you knew you can participate. You knew that you can, expand the product, you know, and Avi, if culture is truly upstream of adoption, it's going to need all of us, because we can all, you know, create clips of this show, create a review of, exactly. of wasabi or whatever it may be, we all have a place to actually participate. We just got to find it. So,
like, not just we have a place for that. Like, there's a moral necessity and a strategic necessity. Like, right. first of all, right, when you know how fucked up and evil fiat is, and you don't do anything about it, you're like morally culprit of you know continuing this evil, right? Complicit, exactly. Thanks. And then secondly, like, I mean, this is fucking hard work, and there's not many people on the front line. Right? And that's a really bad combination, because after a lot of hard work, you're going to burn out at some point and or get taken out. So we need to have basically a constant stream of new people coming in to pick up the slack that others have left off. And, you know, it's like we have to make sure that we at least maintain the quantity and quality of people working on this project. And of course, we should work on improving it. Right. But unfortunately, there's some tendencies, especially in some niche projects, that just fewer and fewer interest in contributions is there. And then that's the death of the project. And that's also quite scary, because eventually with unmaintained projects that nobody's excited about, attacks and like infiltration of security vulnerabilities become much, much, much more likely. So this is quite critical, you know, that everyday people step up and do their part.
Max, let's talk a little bit about something that's been in the spotlight over the last few months, right? Which is back to Wasabi here and the coin joins. Coin joins, obviously, a way of maintaining privacy. But the coin joins typically need a coordinator, right? And it appears that the feds, at least in the US, are making the case that the coordinator, because it's potentially centralized, is someone they can go after. Could you explain to the a layperson listening in the audience who's not that familiar, right, the role of a coordinator in a coin join?
Yeah, so coin join is a very old idea, right? It's from like 2010. It's almost referenced in the white paper as well, even. It's basically multiple people coming together and creating one single Bitcoin transaction that has many inputs and many outputs, with each of these inputs belonging to different people, right? So a collaborative transaction, so to say. Each of us has his own pot of money and we're spending our own money, but we're doing so like in a group transaction with many people. I don't know, something similar of taking, you know, a single person taking a car versus hundreds of people taking a bus. Something like that. And the thing with Bitcoin transactions, obviously, they have to be valid, right? If they're invalid, they won't get in a block. And if something's not in a block, it doesn't exist and your Bitcoin didn't move. And so we want to have, at the end of this process, we all want to have a fully valid Bitcoin transaction. One of the important rules of validity in Bitcoin transactions is, of course, that every input needs to provide a valid witness or signature, right? Everyone needs to sign this transaction with every input that was provided, every coin that is being spent. And this is, you know, a consensus problem, right? We have hundreds of people who need to sign the exactly same transaction, because if there's even just one bit of difference in a transaction that two different people are signing, then the signatures won't check out anymore, right? Every user needs to sign exactly the same transaction. So not just questions of which exact input and output do we want to have in this transaction, but also what's the ordering of the inputs and outputs. And a lot of these details need to be agreed upon, and consensus is difficult. And it's difficult among humans. It's arguably even more difficult among computers. And so we need smart ways of reaching this consensus that everyone can sign the same Bitcoin transaction. And the easy way to do consensus is in a centralized model. Right? We have this one guy, and he tells everyone, hey, look, this is the transaction. These are the inputs and outputs. This is the order. Are you all good with signing this one transaction? Okay, if you like it, sign it. But we have one person kind of calling the shots in proposing a transaction to be signed. The cool thing with CoinJoin is that guy proposing the solution, he cannot steal from other people, because first of all, he doesn't know your private keys, right? And second of all, when he is proposing you this transaction with hundreds of inputs and hundreds of outputs, you don't just blindly sign everything that he gives you. Right? You carefully analyze the transaction that he's proposing to make sure that your inputs are included, and of course your outputs are included, and all of the outputs that you expect. But you don't want to be in a case where you have 10 Bitcoin on the input side and 1 Bitcoin on the output side, and the other 9 Bitcoin just went, you know, to some anonymous attacker. That's not great. So in a CoinJoin, before the user signs the transaction, he verifies that he's not losing any money. And this fundamentally makes it a non-custodial technology, and which is really cool. There are attempts of doing a decentralized CoinJoin coordination as well. There was one research paper by Tim Ruffing, an excellent researcher and cryptographer, called CoinShuffle and CoinShuffle++ in 2016, I think, and quite theoretical paper. So I don't think there was ever an actual implementation. And even in theory, there were a lot of issues with it in terms of scalability, reliability, and just complexity. You know, decentralized systems are super, super complex. So that's why, you know, since the very first actual CoinJoin implementations, everything so far has been a centrally coordinated CoinJoin.
Well, Max, the way you explained, that was a fantastic explanation, by the way, right? And I think you made it very clear that the coordinator does not touch the money at all, right? It's just coordinating the signatures. How is it possible for the DOJ or whoever, whichever authority, to even make the case that this is some kind of money laundering, which is what they're attempting to do? Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's a good question. And like, the simplicity of a CoinJoin coordinator is even more crazy, because technically speaking, the CoinJoin coordinator does not have Bitcoin private keys, right? On that server, on that computer that coordinates the Bitcoin transaction, are literally no private keys. So this backend server literally cannot accept or transfer Bitcoin because he doesn't have the private keys to do so.
Yeah, it is interesting that, I guess, the feds are just looking for any opening, right, to send that chilling effect. So have you, other than that theoretical attempt, the coin shuffle that you talked about from 2016, have you seen any other implementations of coin joins that don't have this single point of coordination?
Yeah, there's really not many others, but one, I guess, noteworthy and recently announced as well is called MSB from Super Testnet, which uses a quite cool, novel application of ring signatures in the coordination scheme, which I haven't heard about so far. So that's some really interesting new research. But it seems a much more doable or implementable decentralized protocol than CoinShuffle. On the other hand, for all of these protocols, the devil is absolutely in the details. And something might seem simple at first glance, but then if you really want to protect the user against any type of edge case, the complexity quickly increases. I think we see similar things with the Lightning Network. Like, the gist of the Lightning Network, even, you know, in its basics, isn't that simple already. But then when you look at, you know, for example, nuances of like mempool fee rate pinning and how this can affect the entire stack, the actual protections that need to be made are just exponentially increasing in complexity. So like a Lightning node right now, like 5 years after launch, is just so much more complex than before, simply because there were a lot of edge case attacks discovered that needed to be addressed. And that takes a lot of engineering effort and simply time for these to be deployed and seen how they behave in the wild. So it's quite a difficult area of research. And I guess another very noteworthy project here is Join Market. And it's noteworthy because it had a very smart strategy, right? Belcher and Waxman realized that the centralized CoinJoin coordination model has so many efficiency improvements that we should simply use that. Centralized consensus absolutely makes sense for practicality reasons. The problem, however, is of course with censorship and downtime and such, So what we can do, we simply replicate the centralized service providers to everyone, right? Like the software, the joint market package that you run has both the client and the backend of the system architecture installed. So the end user can be both a client and a server, which funnily kind of turns it into a peer-to-peer system, right? Because one joint market node, so to say, is equal with any other joint market node because it can do both tasks. But then for any individual interaction between two joint market nodes, there is always a master and a slave, right? A client and a server. But because both have the capability to provide both services, and there is a peer-to-peer discoverability layer for discovering the different peers of the system, we create quite a resilient architecture, despite the fact that at the core, it's still a centralized system.
Got it. And do you see with these types of attempts, maybe one day someone does an implementation of CoinShuffle or joint market sort of continues to grow, do you, in those scenarios, right, do you still see a potential risk to developers that regulators or authorities might come after them for some made up thing like money laundering?
Yeah, I guess that risk is for everyone there. And it's not even just for Bitcoin developers or, let's say, money tech developers. It's like for free speech developers as well. So Nostr Plebs should definitely be cautious about this and become conscious of the extent of the threat and the attack that these systems have in the past suffered and are very likely to continue to suffer. I mean, look at the history of eCash. I mean, like digital cash before Bitcoin. And it's littered with projects that bloomed and went bust, and went bust for different reasons, right? Because they got hacked or ran away or also got shut down by government coercion. These are real scenarios, and we should be at the very least aware that this is the reality.
And Max, obviously Wasabi's main coordinator, ZK Snacks, left the US. I think it's shut down globally now as well, right?
Yep, since June 1st.
So Wasabi, as it stands today, does not support CoinJoins anymore. It's just a desktop wallet. Is that right?
Well, no, Wasabi is, it still is a desktop wallet, right? And can still receive and send Bitcoin. But also the code of how to do CoinJoin is still there in the client, right? You cannot untake and you know, remove code that was published in the past. The tech is still available.
Got it. So if someone wants to run their own coordinator, they can, right? Which is, I get. And I think I did see something that there are just random folks popping up running their own coordinators. I think the challenge there is potentially liquidity, right? And reputation also, presumably.
Yeah, that's a big problem, right? This discoverability as well. But thankfully, you know, some plebs have been tinkering on this very amazing discoverability layer for the internet and private public key systems. I don't know if you've heard about it. But it's really cool stuff, and so this has also, I think, for well over a year now or something like this. Well, time flies. I don't know; might have been shorter, but for quite some time, long.
Max, I don't think there's no podcast about it, so I probably haven't heard about it. What you're about to say.
So there's a new kind number. I'm forgetting the exact kind number, but. It's the CoinJoin coordination announcement kind, I guess. There's a nip somewhere, probably not merged, but there's a PR to one of the many nip repos somewhere that specifies how a CoinJoin coordinator can create a Nostr event and publish this, saying basically which protocol is it using, and then what is the endpoint where the CoinJoin coordination API is reachable. And so there have been, numerous different public keys that have sent events saying that, hey, this is a coordinator and I exist. This is also a replaceable event, and the coordinator has to update it every 15 minutes. So clients somewhat have a liveliness aspect of it too. So some coordinators have just disappeared. You know, just people testing it out, because it's easy to run a coordinator. It's like the BTC Pay plugin. You know, people just click the button and see how it goes and eventually turn it off again. That happens. And yeah, then there are websites and other bots that look for these coordination announcement messages and you know, display them in a nice client. So it's quite similar to how, for example, for eCash, there are, what's it called, bitcoinmints.com, right? That overview of different mint service providers, money warehouse service providers, and where to reach them and which protocol they use and such. And then there could also be reactions to this, right? So people could say, yes, I've tried this one out and it works, or you know, give some custom message or some standardized rating system. All of this, you know, works or can easily be done with Nostr.
Web of trust, right? That's incredible. Yeah. Web of trust for coin joins.
Yeah, and the cool thing is though with coin join coordination, like it's a rather trustless model. Like again, the coordinator cannot steal from you, and with Wabi Sabi, the coordinator cannot spy on you either. So, but the only critical thing here, definitely as you said, is liquidity. And if again, the size of the crowd matters. And if you're the only one, you know, trying to hide in a crowd of one, that doesn't really work. And so that's why, yeah, some coordinators have way more liquidity than others. But that's something that can be rather accurately verified. The question of how much liquidity does any coordinator have?
Yeah. I'm actually looking forward to that. Web of trust-based discoverability for coordinators using Nostr, and then the liquidity will come. You know, Max...
Yeah, Avi, the coordinator aspect is very interesting, where you can run your own coordinator. It really kind of just... It's that whole... I said it at the opening, the whack-a-mole type of thing, where... You cut the head off, and then there's three more. That whole open source decentralization, I don't know if, I mean, there truly is a way to resist all of this. I mean, they might have taken out the big liquidity or whatnot, but it seems like there's always going to be a way to work around this, especially in the open source side.
Yeah, information longs to be free, and information is easy to spread and hard to stifle. So once the code is written, yeah, it exists, and the technology is a reality. And if it's a useful technology that satisfies and solves problems of users, well, and if it's a real problem and people actually need to have a solution, then we'll use the tech that fixes the problem, you know?
Love it.
So Max, on a related note, as you know, we're in the US, QW and I, and the specter of the orange man is looming come November. And apparently, orange man likes orange coin, or so he says anyway.
Who could have known?
He promised he loves it.
but having said that, let's say he keeps up that promise, QW. Right, that he loves Orange Coin and he'll do good things for Orange Coin. Is there a chance then, Max, that Wasabi comes back to the US as a full-fledged coin join service?
I mean, for CK Snacks as a company, that's very unlikely. Like we're in the process of shutting down the company and settling all of the affairs there. So I don't think that, you know, CK Snacks will ever be revitalized or reemerge. But however, you know, the main reason of why we shut down was definitely the regulatory uncertainty. And when certainty gets reestablished, because, you know, for a long time we operated with pretty clear certainty. You know, it's non-custodial. That's not a bank. Like, duh. and so if I guess sanity is reestablished, then we have... other people have a much more easier case of you know, pursuing this type of business.
Yeah, I should have clarified by saying ZK Snacks and not the Wasabi coordinator, because Wasabi, the wallet, can exist and it can work with any any DOS-based coordinator, or otherwise. But on a related topic to Orange Man, and potentially because of his sphere of influence, we saw the beginning of some interesting things happening, positive things happening on the freedom space. We saw Assange being, well, he had to plead guilty, but to free speech, but he is out, and they gave him that option to do it. Does that give you hope for privacy tools, for free speech, seeing the Assange verdict?
Well, definitely. Right. On the other hand, also gives quite a lot of doubt and pessimism that it took so long, and you know, the extent of his torture in the meantime. It's quite a tragic situation, obviously, but it does feel on many ways that the pendulum is swinging towards the direction of freedom. Of course, doesn't mean that there won't be any pain in the meantime or any short-term volatility. Nevertheless, I think there's been a lot of public support and outcry for crimes as handling of such cases, and I do think that there is some effect to that as well. Ultimately, though, there's more work to be done, that we'll be curious to see of how it goes. But it won't be a boring time, that's for sure.
And happy birthday, Julian. I know you're listening. I understand your birthday was 2 days ago, based off that Stella Assange post.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just think it's pretty great that you know, freedom fighters who like Julian and Stella are also using the amazing tech that, clubs have built over the last while now. Like, we are slowly but surely establishing a technological arsenal of tools that works and that can actually protect people, even against sophisticated and serious attacks. So the longer we get to build and fine tune and innovate in these areas, the better it is. So I'm quite still pessimistic of the extent of the threats and danger that are to come in the next couple of years for people on the forefront. However, in especially the long run, I am still rather optimistic.
Yeah, you just brought a thought to my mind. It seems like the way this world is, especially post-COVID, it seems like there's definitely a more trend to making decentralization more in vogue, I suppose, more popular, kind of like that sovereign individual theory where, we start to decentralize. I think they kind of jumped the shark on what they're trying to do. And, I feel like the information's never been more decentralized, all the way from the mainstream media propaganda, just not being watched anymore, listened to. People recognize that they're being gaslit. A podcast like ours all of a sudden have some sort of, signal to it. And I think there's a lot of ours. Just like us out there. So I think ultimately the way forward is kind of having that lost in the crowd type of thing where the information is so decentralized, they don't know where to stop or start to silence us.
Yeah, I do think we have a very obvious and seemingly successful strategy towards liberty. It's about distributing risks ultimately, and that's what Satoshi taught us. If there's a single computer, a single guy in charge with creating a database and storing that database and updating that database and verifying that database, if all of that is just one guy, then you shoot him and the system's gone, right? So we need to compartmentalize each of the critical aspects of a service that needs to be provided, and then distribute so that there's not just one provider for that niche, but that there's numerous provider for that niche and a free market choice for individual to choose different markets. Right? We don't just have one miner. We have as many miners as we want and an absolute competition and anti-monopoly, right? A monopoly is when anyone can, or when someone can restrict a new market participant from entering this market and providing the same service. You don't have the power to enforce a monopoly on Bitcoin mining because it's just fucking math, right? It's hashing. Like, it's just infeasible to stop people from hashing. And that is what makes Bitcoin such a resilient system. Satoshi has clearly differentiated the different services that need to be provided and then automated these and distributed the capability of providing that service and the coordination mechanism so that anonymous people can coordinate the market process of providing these services. And that's a beautiful solution. Nostr is the same thing, right? We replicate and we distribute risk. And that is a simple strategy that seems to work.
So speaking of Nostr, Max, when did you find it? What were your first thoughts when you started using Nostr?
Yeah, first
were
time
you,
I heard
Were
of,
you a boomer when you first started?
I was a wizard when I first started because I first started with Diagon Alley, you know, the OG marketplace idea from Ben Ark. Him and I go way back. We did many videos and podcasts together on the World Crypto Network back in the days, including probably some of my favorite are like 4 hour long videos on the difference between, you know, socialism and capitalism. Because we're both, vehement anarchists, but differ quite a lot in the nuances of our view. So it's always been an absolute pleasure to talk with Ben. And so when he first told me about the idea of a resilient marketplace using private public key systems and a web of trust, I mean, you know, it's obviously a fucking great idea. And then I also know, though, that Ben is a, how do I say that nicely, a very enthusiastic proof of concept hacker. In other words, he writes very shitty code that's impossible to maintain. But then eventually someone like Fiat Jeff comes in to somewhat bring structure and clarity to the protocol was, I think, very much needed.
Does he still own Nostr.com?
Yeah, I think he does. both Nostr.com and Nostr.org. And so he's setting himself up for...
He rushed to the the purchase on that one. I think he was trying to sell that. I think it was... he had a timetable on it, but I think it was... Was it $1 million, Avi?
$5 million.
There we go.
Should be 21. I mean, obviously, right?
Avi, that's a good offer to throw out there. Have you put your bid in yet?
I'll pay 5 million cents.
So I mean, you are promo code Nostr at all these events, Avi. It's only right you fork it out for Nostr.com.
That's true. So what looking ahead or even staying in the present with Nostr, Max, what excites you most about it? Which projects? Well, you said you called yourself an other stuff maximalist when it came to development, but are you one when it comes to Nostr as well?
Yeah, I think so. I was never much of a shit poster. Like Bitcoin Twitter was the main reason why I came back to social media, basically. And so Bitcoin Nostr, I guess, is the main reason why I still do the shit posting here. And so I guess for that aspect, that's the main scratch your own itch part, I guess, in my daily use of Nostr, right? It's just see what my friends are doing, and toss the magical internet money, you know, to, I don't know, because it's fun. but then, you know, there's numerous things that Nostr is just so beautiful for. I've been a toxic PGP maximalist, you know, one of those guys that, you know, hands you the PGP paper slip fingerprint, you know, every time you meet him and like, these types of things I tried like long before Nostr existed, and bro, it does not work. PGP Web of Trust is so beautifully designed and so shitty to use that nobody does. And then of course big practical problem with that. But then, you know, when I see nowadays what we do with Nostr of how effortlessly we managed to create that web of trust, how just easy it is that people don't even realize it, right? You're just shitposting and liking other people and following them because, you know, like that's what you do online. But turns out that's the Trojan horse to actually give us a honestly generated, verifiable web of trust for private public keys. Like it's just a genius UX hack to one of the most critical and important problems that PGP tried to address and failed. So yeah, that web of trust aspect is mind blowing. It's so huge. It's like unbelievably huge.
It's poetic, honestly. The way the parallels and cohesion of the pleb culture with Noster, Bitcoin, and then the value for value mechanism. It's like they were all built for each other.
Yeah, exactly. It fits so beautifully together, right? And I guess that's, you know, truth resonates on different levels. And so I know maybe that's why it feels like we're onto something. This tech stack just comes together so nicely, and that's really exciting. Right? And also like the I guess the freedom to experiment. I don't know, like as a non-coder, that kind of seems like the biggest downside of Noster, that like anyone can just create a standard and anyone can create competing standards that do the same thing, and we just have like a couple, like 30,000 numbers to allocate them. Like it just seems like a huge mess, right? But in reality, that natural emergent protocol specification aspect of it is really, really interesting. I wonder how that system, like that social system of coordinating different contributors to Noster Tech and ensuring that they're still in sync, when that gets under serious attack, I wonder what type of paralysis we have. I mean, it's an absolute mess in Bitcoin, right? Try changing some of the protocol parameters now or adding something new, like good fucking luck. And I guess it's to a large extent in the nature of decentralized systems. And I really wonder how Noster will manage these same problems.
And one thing that could happen is you have clients who want some, or you know, new clients pop up that want a specific event kind, right, that gives them the features they need. And they might end up hard forking themselves into oblivion. I think we might end up seeing a lot of that, or we could end up seeing the protocol fragment as well, right? In the bad scenario.
Yeah, yeah. But again, right? It's a communications protocol that's not as critical to not fork than a money protocol. You know, and
that's where the interoperability comes into play, where we have the power now as a user to just move where we want to. So, you know, the client has a responsibility to do what's right.
Yeah, definitely. So like one of the other things that just super impressed me with Noster is another thing Ben Ark made, the IoT controllers. Like that's just so cool, right? That you can have a completely dumb device, no static public IP, right? Like just something hidden behind a firewall, and you can talk to it and it can talk back to you. And it's just like a couple lines of Python code and the Schnorr signature to make that work. And again, like such an effortless solution to such a huge problem, right? Where sure, there might be some, you know, hole punch peer-to-peer stuff that we could do, but we could also just use signatures and WebSockets, you know? So it's that makes it a really compelling, at least a compelling proof of concept machine, right? If probably like, and maybe that's enough, right? If all that Noster does is that it makes like a million hackers, it gives them the right tools to come up with a gazillion proof of concept things. And if that's all it does, then maybe that's great enough, because then we have a bunch of new ideas that we can later build with serious infrastructure, you know, some actual peer-to-peer key-based system. Then, you know, that will be great.
Yeah, for sure, Max. I do want to go back to one thing you were saying about Web of Trust, right? Which is really emerged through memes and shitposting, right? on Noster, which that's where PGP failed. So, but let's extend that for a second. So are you saying then that I I've built a web of trust through, or you know, my web of trust through the people I follow because they should post the way I like it. I like their memes, right? And then would that then translate to other use cases within Nosta, for instance? Like I would trust those people in that web for commerce or for something else. Is that what you were implying?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, I mean, web of trust can be very loosely defined as just some metadata on top of keys, arguably, right? And so any type of metadata that we produce on top of keys helps build this web of trust. And so with Nostr, like all of it is metadata, right? We have metadata of like not just what kind is it, but also like, you know, it's a reaction to something. Like just by the fact that you like something, that helps build the web of trust. Because you're not likely to like something from a spam bot, right? For example, and then of course following is a much even stronger signal in the web of trust, or something as we spoke earlier, right? The reputation ranking for the eCash mints, these things carry much more weight than just hey, I'm following this shit poster. I might disagree with him, but at least I want to see his posts. Right? Or we could, and probably there exists already, some NIP that clearly identifies the levels of verification that has been done, similar to with PGP. With PGP, you can like say, hey, I've like verification level 0. You know, I'm just signing this, but I'm not making any statement of accuracy to the key, right? Or level 1 would be, yeah, I've compared it to his Twitter bio or something. Level 2 would be, yes, I met him in person and he told me that this is his key. Level 3 would be, I met him in person, shook his hand, and did KYC, right? I checked his government identity and made sure he didn't hide anything nasty, you know, in his butt, got him complete naked. Great, full KYC done. That's level 3, right? So these type of additional metadata classifications can be used. That's just another NIP. And hopefully it will get some adoption. But the cool thing is that even the very naive and simple things, right, just like a kind one, that already is metadata that helps us create this web of trust. So even the super naive case of just shitposting or just liking something helps us with this web of trust, and we can make it much more specialized with following or even other key verification schemes.
Yeah, it's certainly super powerful. You know, Max, there's one question that I've been pondering, and I'm sort of changing tracks here, about Wasabi, and maybe it's been answered already. It sounded like BS to me when I read this 2 years back, but there was this Laura Shin story on the Ethereum DAO hack. Do you remember this one from a couple of years back?
I'm not sure.
It was, you know, she was in Laura Shin as a reporter, and she was following the trail on the Ethereum DAO funds, you know, from the 2016, the DAO incident when Ethereum eventually led to Ethereum Classic and Ethereum, I guess, forming. And then the funds, you know, it went, they changed them to Bitcoin, and then apparently they used, at some point down the road, they used Wasabi to coinjoin them. And then I guess the feds employed the chain anal guys, and they claim to have demixed the coin joins. I had read it and I said, this sounds like nonsense to me. And I don't know if you've heard the story, or and if you have, has it been debunked?
You know, the reviewing or analyzing the work of these surveillance companies is quite tricky because they're not open source, right? So we can't really... We don't have a reproducible process of how they came to the conclusions that they advertised, and that makes, you know, these types of conversations super difficult. What's also quite lacking, unfortunately, is I guess scientific academic research on these things, right? Like there's an enormous amount of academic research on the security of private public key crypto systems and such, but unfortunately, not the same for other privacy nuance schemes, like, for example, CoinJoin. So there have been a few universities, and we've worked with some of them, on trying to quantify and analyze blockchain transactions, specifically coin joins, in somewhat of a reproducible and real way. And it's not trivial, right? However, like in some cases, it's very easy. And of course, especially when there is a user mistake, right? I mean, like, let's take the extreme example, address reuse, right? You reuse the same address for like 10 years to withdraw from Kraken, and now you put that address reused thing on the input side of a coin join, and you put the exact same address, you know, on the output side of the coin join, for example. Like this would be one extreme way that the user can shoot himself in the foot just decrease his privacy substantially. There's of course much more realistic or nuanced things that if you get some change output that does not yet have privacy, and later you consolidate it with an actually private input and such, or you consolidate like 100 private inputs, but because you consolidate them all at once, that reveals a lot of information. So these are all ways that that privacy can be decreased after the fact. Those are very difficult to quantify and actually, you know, make statements of, okay, this is how much it got worse and such. On the other hand, though, when the technology is used properly, then I would argue it's very difficult to reason and analyze the flow of funds, etc. It might not be impossible, right? But at least for me, trying to break it for a while myself and thinking of how ways that this could be circumvented, it's definitely not easy. I like when I look at a transaction and try to break it, I simply have to give up quite soon. Now, obviously, I'm not the best data scientist, or I'm not even a data scientist at all. So I'm sure if you have a lot of compute power and some sophisticated AI models, maybe not just even now, but like in 10, 20 years in the future, because remember, like, these transactions won't be forgotten. They're here forever. So there might be adversaries in the near term or far term future that have way superior computing capabilities or algorithms. It's really, really tough to say, like, what's the actual level of privacy that you get with a single round of coin join.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point there, Max, that the data has persisted forever on the time chain. So at some point, maybe 50 years down the road, quantum computing or whatever it might be, right, whatever tool they have then, maybe they'll be able to unravel some of these coin joins. But
yeah, timing aspect is very important to consider for your threat model, right? So, like, for example, like, you should be aware of who is your attacker, right? Like, against whom are you defending yourself? Like, what's the capital of this attacker, right? Is he attacking you with like 10 bucks worth of, you know, diesel and time, or does he have like billions at his disposal? For how long do you want to protect yourself? Just for the next 30 minutes? If someone finds out after 30 minutes, it's fine? Or, you know, do you need this to be private for a year, 10 years, right? Of course, the longer you want something to stay hidden, the more difficult it is, especially when you have sophisticated and well-funded adversaries. If you're trying to protect yourself or to hide from, like, you know, nation state level agencies for the next like 20 years, this is going to be an extremely expensive security protocol that needs to be established in order to protect seriously against such an adversary. And for most everyone, it's not realistic to do that. It will not be profitable. But, you know, some things are just fine to, for a short time, you know, like, perfect example, you want to get a gift for your wife. You don't want to like let her find out that, you know, what the gift is. But she will eventually find out, and it's okay, right? So you only need to hide it for a little bit. And, you know, she's not that motivated of an attacker. Well, maybe she is. You know, she wants to get a sneak peek. That might be motivation enough. And the question is, how much money would she, like, actually spend on trying to get to it?
Here's a public service announcement for plebs. If your wife is working with chain analysis to unravel your transactions, then it might be, you might have to ask yourself a very serious question about where you're going with your life. No, I'm kidding there, Max. Yes, your point is taken. I think the timeline makes a big difference. So Max, let's move on to more cheerful topics. You are a digital
Avi. Was his analogy did that fall in line with our anniversaries that we just had? What does he know about us?
Did your wife
hide a present for 2 months and she just opened it yesterday? So it was that one hit. That was close to home there.
Nice. Yeah, but you see, that's the thing. Like, privacy isn't like this criminal thing that evil masterminds do. Like, privacy is something that everyone does. Like, you choose all the time whom you speak to and what you tell them and when you tell them. And then, like, that's just life. That's what humans do. So it's not anything shady. Oh,
there's no surprise party without privacy, right?
Yeah.
So, Max, you're a digital nomad, or a nomad even these days, right? What's that been like?
Yeah, that's been great. You know, I definitely got influenced by books like Sovereign Individual or Second Realm on how there are different ways of life that have a quite substantial difference in the real life liberation that can be achieved. A stationary life in many ways makes you very vulnerable to attack. You stand out a lot in the sense that people know that you're there and they know where they can find you. You build a long-term reputation with this one place. So it just opens a lot of doors for potential attack. And there are other ways of life that you know, remove some of these potential threat vectors. And nomadism is one of them. So this was something that was always curious to me of this strategy seems useful in theory, but is it actually in practice? So 2019, I basically went on, started a, how do you call it? Like a social experiment of hyper-Bitcoinization in real life, you know? So I quit my fiat jobs. I quit my fiat bank accounts. Sold, you know, the remaining cash that I have basically, and got a caravan, a truck, you know, a van to sleep in. That, you know, was the only thing that I owned basically, and just went on the road to meet fascinating people that work on topics and problems that are interesting to me. You know, to be very aware and selective of your surroundings, both physically in terms of, you know, the international jurisdiction or the like surroundings and the nature of it, but also the people, right? If all of a sudden you, like, especially if you're in a van, it's like, it's so extreme. Like, where do you want to wake up tomorrow is a serious question that you can ask yourself. And the answer is whatever the fuck you want, right? If you want to wake up tomorrow, like, in Spain, drive 1,000 kilometers, totally doable in a day, and voila, you're on the other side of the continent, right? And then this gives like maximum amount of opportunity and potential and freedom, right? You could go wherever, and that's great, but it's also somewhat scary because then, well, if I could be wherever I want, then I better be in the places that I actually like and that's actually great, and then you're not. You're not just aimlessly at a place because you're at the place, but there can be some reason for it, right? So I traveled to numerous places simply to meet the people, specifically, of course, for Bitcoin stuff and Bitcoin conferences. So I've for a large extent, my main place of residence is Bitcoin conferences, and then in between you just kind of hang out until the next one comes. Or you start some meetup in some place where you're currently at.
You know, Avi, what is it about 2019 that made people want to get in vans and start driving? Because if you recall Nathan Day's episode a couple episodes ago, he did that in 2019, I believe, as well. Exactly. With his family.
I'm pretty proud of the refugee class of 2019, because we totally front ran it. Like, yeah. We totally fucking knew it, and we had an excellent strategy right when shit hits the fan.
Yeah, no, that is remarkable. It's just playing that back. Yeah, it's once again, it's poetic there.
Yeah. No, and this, like, in general, like, I guess front running is to some extent a good way of how to look at this. Like, I front run my own debankment, right? Because it was obvious that if you're gonna have at least an inkling of interest in Bitcoin, you're gonna get persecuted and censored, and your bank accounts are gonna get shut down. Like, it's an inevitability. I mean, let's be serious, right? So let's just do it now. Like, let's take away the power over of the attacker over me, and that fear that he might take away something that I treasure. Let's just get rid of the stuff that he could take away from me, and let's figure out life in a way that is still joyful without these certain privileges. And then the power of this invisible attacker, that fear that grips your heart, is gone. Because, well, okay, like, what are they going to do? Like, send me an offer to get a bank account so just that they can take it away afterwards? Like, no.
Any favorite? That sounds fantastic, by the way, Max. Right? You can't find me. I quit. Sort of attitude, yeah. There. Any favorite place in your travels?
There's many ways to answer this, Ryan. I guess it's cyberspace for sure. You couldn't do it without cyberspace. Like, the nomading without cyberspace would be such a pain in the ass. Even being settled in a stationary place without cyberspace would be a pain in the ass. So I guess just meet space without cyberspace is pretty shitty, all things considered. but then another thing I realized, it's not, of course, it's important what the outside environment is like, but what's also very important that your shell is constant, that there's some consistency and stability in your very close surroundings. And I had that with the van, the caravan, right? That's such a genius hack, because you can be outside in the crazy chaotic world, you know, in different places, different people all the time, but you always have your box of stuff with you, right? And you always sleep in the same box, and it's yours, and you know every bit of it, and you know that you can rely on it, right? This is an anchor point in a nomadic lifestyle, which I think is absolutely a substantial hack. I hear a lot that people get tired and drained from just moving from Airbnb to Airbnb all the time and living out of a backpack. And yeah, that's a pretty extreme lifestyle. And the edges of that can be smoothed off when you have some consistency and some box with you. So I would say the best place, like, to be is, like, I guess, a high quality surrounding that might be a van, or that might just be a nice backpack with the nice stuff that you have, you know, your favorite clothes and things like this. I noticed that I don't need much, but I would like the things that I do have to be excellent and high quality and be really useful and valuable to me. And that type of surrounding creates a good setting almost regardless where you are.
Love it. So what's next for you, Max? What are you working on? You're writing a book? Are you making a movie? Are you building a new app? What's happening?
Just casually working on the ending of human slavery. You know, nothing new. nothing changes, right? We gotta work on freedom tech. It's the best. it's seemingly the best approach to liberating a substantial amount of humans in the short term. Like, we need to end fiat money. Like, it's just not acceptable anymore at this point. And Bitcoin is on the best track of doing that. So we just gotta, you know, make sure that we drive in the home run and you know, actually finish the job, so to say. And I think still that my, I guess, interest and skills in monetary economics and philosophy is well suited to continue on that task specifically. But it's not just the money tech either. Like, to some extent, I'm not yet, but it feels like I'm starting to be done with the money. You know, there's like only weirdos work on money. Everyone else works for money. But that's also why I'm so happy that Noster came around, because it has all of the core principles and the beauty that I love so much about Bitcoin, and it applies it in a non-monetary context, right? Now it's just about shit posting. That's cute, you know. That's not as stressful as fixing the most critical resource of humanity. it's just about talking with friends. You know, it's much less of a responsibility and burden. So I look forward to a little chill time in the shit posting zone, I guess.
So no books, Max. Weren't you writing something, or were you pitching a movie?
Yeah, I was writing, like, I don't know, it was like almost 4 or 5 years ago where I started writing a book and promised people that I would write a book. And then life happened and building stuff was more exciting than writing about this stuff. So now, however, I really think that I should finalize this. So the book is called The Praxeology of Privacy. So I'm trying to marry the praxeology of Austrian economics with the cypherpunk philosophy and strategy. Like two niche areas that have been very close to my heart for my life so far. And I think there's some unique, interesting way of bridging these two worldviews for a quite beautiful holistic understanding. And so I want to kind of ratchet in. This is kind of, I guess, somewhat like a, like the culmination of my economics and Bitcoin efforts over those last couple of years. I'm looking forward to doing this. And just today, I don't know, I've been thinking about it. Maybe if I start talking on podcasts about it, I'll actually do it. But we really need an audiobook of The Lodging of Wayfaring Men. Like, it's a fucking great book. Like, if you haven't read it yet, you shouldn't be listening to nonsense podcasts like this. You should be watching, reading serious books, you know, serious pieces of literature and culture. But definitely Paul Rosenberg's A Lodging of Wayfaring Men.
Avi has it on his, he's staring at it right now. He hasn't opened it yet.
So Grafton was the one who got me onto this, Max. And he, you know, we talked about it with him a couple of months back on the show. He sent me a copy. I still have it. But is that, you're going to do the audiobook?
Well, I'm, you know, like,
I'd love there to get a couple... Paul on the show, by the way. Just heads up.
Yeah, Paul is absolutely excellent and to talk to, and great guest for interviews as well. You know, there's just a couple books that are so, like, incredibly, monumentally important, right? Like, there's Man, Economy, and State with Power and Markets. Like that's the one book about economics. Like, it's just crazy. There's things like Crypto Economics, The Fundamental Principles of Bitcoin, right, by Eric Waskiel. Like, there is no better book on Bitcoin. Like, it's so fundamentally amazing. And these books need to be cherished and spread, because the ideas are just too beautiful to be ignored. And so that's, for example, why I did the audiobook to Crypto Economics. You know, it's on a podcast, like, get it on Fountain or wherever, because, like, people need to read this shit. It's so fucking important, right? And I have the same feeling with A Lodging of Wayfaring Men. It's like the Atlas Shrugged of cypherpunks, right? It's and it gives you not just a real and objective display of reality and how the world really is and how it operates, but it also gives you this hope of, yeah, the world is a fucked up place, but we have all the power to fix it and to manifest a world that is so unspeakably better than what we have right now. And the strategy to get there is fucking obvious. It's not difficult. Just live a free life and don't steal and don't harm others and build beautiful things. And you know, that's what Bitcoiners do to a very large extent. And maybe once you read some piece of fiction that tells a narrative of the natural conclusion, the natural extent of the path that we're already at, I think it just reinvigorates you and gives you even more confidence and ability to move forward in a proper and honest way. So yeah, the book is a must read. And if a couple more people read it because I do the audiobook, then I think it's a couple hours worth well spent.
Well, Bobby, are you hyped up now? Are you going to read that thing?
I am going to read that thing. I've had it on my phone for the last 2 months since Warsaw. Actually, that's when Grafton sent it to me. You were there in Warsaw too, right, Max? Yeah. And so yes, I will. We'll make sure I read it. Well, Max, it was a pleasure and honor to have you on the show, my friend. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Oh yeah, thank you, and likewise. You know, thanks for spreading the propaganda. That's super important. Like, you know, this is a meme war. This is a morality, a spiritual, cultural war. And sure, writing the code is important and shipping the software and that's cool and all, but we need to change people's minds and hearts, right? We need to make them aware of you know, the state of reality and the consequences of actions that might not be considered otherwise. That in and of itself, the educational effort is outstanding, but probably even more so, a sanctuary for those persecuted and on the front line of this war, because it can get lonely out there. And having a shit-talking podcast where we just hang out and have fun and be there for each other is really meaningful and powerful. So, you know, that... I think I speak for a lot of contributors that we find a lot of refuge in the sanity of podcasts, and thanks for that.
We're doing our tiny little bit in adding to the culture, Max. That's what this is about. Create a culture that brings people in.
Yeah, exactly. And we're winning. We have a way better culture. Like, that's like, we have so many advantages. It's outrageous, you know, but the truth sells itself. You don't need to try hard.
Yeah, certainly does. All right, Max. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Max. It was a pleasure being a student here today. I really appreciate you coming on the show. And anybody likewise. Listening, please support Value for Value. Give us a boost to Graham, comment, do anything, get involved. We'd love to chat. So always listen on Fountain if you can. And also I know it's a new, it's Fanfare, right, Avi? That's a new one. We're still trying to get some episodes on there. It's me slacking actually, but, I'll get the most recent ones up there soon, but, thank you very much. And, see you next week.
Bye-bye.